Hello and welcome to the Leap of Faith. Well, it was 350 years ago on the 30th of November that Dean Jonathan Swift was born. Known to many as a familiar face on our currency at one stage for, of course, Gulliver's Travels and indeed some other historic situations. And on tonight's programme, what we're going to do is we're going to trace some of the footsteps and pass by some of the parts of Dublin that he was famous for, ending our trip in St. Patrick's Cathedral. And of course, as part of those birthday celebrations for Jonathan Swift, there's a festival underway this weekend. We'll have more information about that for you as we go along. On my journey this evening, keeping me company and giving us an insight into the man, is Albert Fenton. Albert, welcome to the Leap of Faith. You have a bit of an insight into this man. You've been writing a few books and a few texts on him.
Well, I've always been interested in Jonathan Swift. My family go back a long way in St. Patrick's Cathedral. And Swift has always been a favourite writer of mine, and obviously as our greatest and one of the longest-serving deans, has always been of interest to me.
Now, of course, you can't go a day without accidentally quoting the man. Things like "Every dog has its day" and "Beauty's in the eye of the beholder." He was famous for his one-liners and his quips.
He was indeed, and one I always like, a very pithy remark: "It was a brave man who first ate an oyster."
He's probably right. Well, now, where we are at this very minute is we're not far from Seven Hoys Court in the centre of Dublin. The connection for Jonathan Swift to Hoys Court?
Well, that's, of course, where he was born. The building has long been demolished. It's around the corner here from where we are now in what is now Ship Street. His parents were Abigail and Jonathan. His father, Jonathan, died before he was born. But, of course, there is a great deal of controversy about his birth. It's very, very possible that Jonathan was not his father, but that his father was either Sir John Temple or Sir William Temple. But that, of course, can never be cleared up now.
Now, that would have made a complication for him with his later friendships.
Of course, and it's probably because it is generally now considered that Stella was definitely Sir William Temple's daughter. If Jonathan had some kind of relationship there, it would have certainly been a reason for them not marrying in later life, if they did not marry.
Because? Because
they would have been related to each other. They would have been brother and sister.
And we may actually come across them again later in our walk. Albert, let's continue on a little bit further. And what we'll do now is we'll spend a little time talking about Jonathan Swift as an Irishman. He was born into a different Ireland. And around 1700, Ireland wasn't the same kind of place it is now. So would he have considered himself to be an Irishman?
I don't think he would, really. I think he would have considered himself English and rather in an outpost of the empire here. He would, of course, have loved a canonry in England or a bishopric. He would have loved one of those lovely, lovely canonries in Westminster or Ely, where duties were very light and emoluments were very high. But, of course, Queen Anne took a dislike to him, and therefore that was not possible.
Why did he fall out with Queen Anne?
Well, there's two possible reasons. One was a pamphlet he wrote about the conduct of the war with France, and the other was they think she was rather scandalised by his book, The Tale of a Tub.
Let's walk a little bit closer now towards our final destination, St. Patrick's Cathedral, and on the way we'll talk about some of his famous satire. So, Albert, from Hoy Street, from the place of his birth, to Werburgh's Church.
Yes, and that's where Swift would have been baptised.
And ahead of him was a career, which we'll come to in a minute, but he ended up in Kilkenny, of all places, as a student.
Indeed, he was very young when he went to Kilkenny. He was only 6 years old. And he stayed there until he was 15, when at that relatively early age, he went to Trinity College, where, of course, he took holy orders. First of all, he had to serve his time as a clergyman, which he did in parish called Larrachor in County Meath, and that, very importantly, carried with it a canonry of Dunlavin in St. Patrick's Cathedral, and that was his entry into St. Patrick's Cathedral.
So Dublin doesn't get a claim on him completely?
I'm afraid not.
All right, so let's walk now at this stage towards St. Patrick's Cathedral, where we'll find out just a little bit more about the other part of Dean Swift, which is, of course, his writing and his work as a satirist. So, Albert, as we come around the corner here, our first sight of St. Patrick's Cathedral in the distance, and a good time to I suppose, to mention as well, Swift's work as a satirist. Many people will know Gulliver's Travels, for example, as a children's story, but at the time it was actually quite hard-hitting. He was having a go at a few people.
Oh, he was indeed. And Gulliver's Travels, when it was first published, many people thought it was a travel book. And in fact, one bishop said he could only believe half of it. But of course, Swift wrote many, many works over the years. And of course, his journals to Stella, the wonderful letters to Stella. And in England, he was a member of the Scriblerus Club, which of course included some of the greatest writers of the age, Pope and Congreve and Arbuthnot. It was in 1720 that he began work on Gulliver, and it was published, of course, in 1726. Then, of course, 1724-25 saw the Drapier Letters, those famous works which destroyed Wood's halfpence, with which Archbishop King helped him. And for that, of course, he was granted the freedom of the city of Dublin. And the scroll awarding him that can be seen in St. Patrick's. He died in 1728, of course, but a year later, that tremendous and bitter work, A Modest Proposal, was published, which still causes great consternation today.
With all of his satire, one wonders how he would fare in modern times. He was hardly politically correct, was he?
He certainly was not politically correct, but I think he possibly would have had a column in one of our newspapers in which his invective would certainly have been of great consternation to the government of the day.
Swift on Twitter is kind of an interesting idea, isn't it? What he would make of modern social media.
It certainly would. He might vie with the President of the United States in that regard.
So, Albert, the final part of our journey, we're going across St. Patrick's Park and into St. Patrick's Cathedral. Let's go. So, Albert, we've come around the corner, past the deanery, and we're down here now at the south porch of St. Patrick's Cathedral. This would have been a walk that Swift would have made many times.
Well, he would, of course, but the environs would have been vastly different in his day. In 1860, there was the huge restoration of the cathedral, so the south porch would not have probably existed in Swift's day.
OK, so bring us down now as we head down the steps here into St. Patrick's Cathedral. And the first port of call you're going to bring us to is actually where Jonathan Swift is buried. And as we go in, you want to tell a story about Swift's servant.
Yes, indeed. In the south transept of the cathedral, there's a rather delightful small monument, in marked contrast to the elaborate monuments to all the great men of their time. And it's to Swift's servant, Alexander McGee. And if I may read what is on the monument, "Here lieth the body of Alexander McGee, servant to Dr. Swift, Dean of St. Patrick's. His grateful master caused this monument to be erected in memory of his discretion, fidelity and diligence in that humble station." And the interesting thing is that Swift, in fact, wanted to put servant and friend, but the chapter dissuaded him from putting friend. You couldn't have a servant, the friend of the great dean. And for once, the dean capitulated. He didn't often, but he did on this occasion.
So we'll head down to the inside of the cathedral here in St. Patrick's, and we're going to head towards Dean Swift's final resting place. Albert, we've come through into the interior of the cathedral here, and here is the final resting place of Dean Swift himself. Who's beside him?
Beside Swift here is the grave of Esther Johnson, Stella, whom he immortalised in verse and in prose. It will never be known whether they married. It is possibly thought they married in 1723, but it'll never be known, and it will merely give rise to many more articles and books about the whole controversy.
Well, Albert, we'll talk to you again in a moment, but also here with us this evening is the current Dean of St. Patrick's, and that's the very Reverend Dr. William Morton. Dean, you are in a direct line back from Swift. How does it actually sit with you as you're here? Do you feel his presence sometimes?
I actually do feel his presence quite often, both here in the cathedral and also too in the deanery, because I know there was a fire in the house in 1781, and I know he had died in 1745, but we believe that quite a bit of the building remained the house in which he had actually lived. So I do, when I look at the books that he wrote and had published, and I think of the rooms and coming in the entrance hall and everything, I do often think that his spirit is surrounding us. And certainly here in the cathedral, when we look at the diversity of services which are held here, I think that, you know, a lot of that probably reflects his contribution as dean, in that during his time here, he sought to regularize celebrations of the Eucharist. They wouldn't have been that frequent in many churches, and he certainly strove to make sure that there would have been at least a weekly Eucharist in St. Patrick's Cathedral. And although he wasn't a singer, he was very happy to have a very prestigious choir, and we're delighted to have a thoroughly prestigious choir with us here now. So a lot of what he sought to implement, we continue in our day and generation to build upon here.
So a lot has been done, and a lot of people have looked at his work as a satirist, but you were looking at him as a clergyman. Is there an extra insight into that role that he had here?
I think we see in him a person who put into practice his belief in God and the Christian faith. We see a person of immense kindness. We see it in his outreach to people in society who suffered from social injustices. So I think if he were here today, he would be reaching out to people who are really on the margin in society in terms of homeless, people who are underprivileged, people who are, of course, trying to grapple with mental illness. And of course, his legacy was to the building of St. Patrick's Hospital here. So, and through the office of Dean, I am a member of the board of St. Patrick's Hospital. So there's a wonderful sort of continuity and continuation of all the aims and objectives of SWIFT through us here in the cathedral and in Dublin in our generation.
Dean, you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation about the presence of SWIFT, but you actually have something a little bit more concrete of him here in terms of a death mask.
Yes, which we will show you now, if you would care to walk over to the case which contains it here.
A death mask is the time, I suppose, the way people recorded famous people, rather than obviously photography not being available. So this was a fairly regular thing for people to do.
It was. It was a sort of medium that was available then, where they had made a sort of a plaster cast of what the person looked like. It's very interesting now to, you know, have the features of the person and to know something about them.
Albert's still with us. Albert, there's a skull here, which, and I think you have a very interesting story too. It's not the actual skull, but it's a cast of one. And this was after an autopsy that was done on SWIFT a couple of years after his death, many years after his death.
Yes, it was by Sir William Wilde, of course, father of the great Oscar. And he found that there was a chipped bone behind the ear of SWIFT, which would have caused the nausea and the dizziness from which SWIFT suffered for most of his life, and certainly in the latter part of it. Ironically, nowadays it would have been fixed in a matter of minutes, probably, by a surgeon. But then, of course, there was no cure.
And, of course, you would argue that this might have also been the reason that there was a belief that he was mentally ill towards the end of his life, and you'd argue that he wasn't.
Indeed. He was never mad, although it was often thought that he was. And, of course, he left his money to found St. Patrick's Hospital. He left the little wealth he had to build a house for fools and mad, and showed by one satiric touch no nation needed it so much. But of course, the little wealth he had was actually quite a lot. He was a wealthy man, and St. Patrick's Hospital cost about £14,000, which I'm assured today would be around about £3 million.
And one more person with us here in St. Patrick's Cathedral is Andrew Smith, the Education Officer. Andrew, the festival coming to, a peak at the moment. And what was the overall objective, and what did you want to achieve with it?
Well, we really wanted to highlight the life and legacy of Jonathan Swift through a series of events which either reflected on that body of work or maybe responded to it. And we were very keen to make it very topical. So, for example, we have events which are serving as fundraisers for elements of his legacy. We're fundraising for local charities, helping the poor and the homeless. We're raising money for mental health, of course, as well. So it's very important to us that we're serving his legacy really through the festival, but also raising general awareness of Swift as a cultural figure in Ireland.
We'll give details of where people can find out more information at the festival shortly. But what I do want to do is give you an opportunity just to mention two events on Saturday and Sunday this weekend.
So on Saturday the 25th, we have a concert in the cathedral with Glenn Hansard, which is again raising money for local charities. On Sunday evening, we have a food event where we're serving a candlelit dinner in the cathedral, and we're using recipes from the 17th century. From Swift's era. I'm going to serve that in the cathedral. And then on the following Thursday, on Swift's birthday itself, on the 30th of November, we have a big concert in the cathedral with Mary Coughlan, Dermot Kennedy, Mongoose, and we also have, fittingly, some poets coming in to do some spoken word pieces. And again, all of the tickets, the money raised through those are going to local charities.
Andrew Smith, Education Officer, thank you very much indeed. And also to Albert Fenton for his insight into Swift, and to Dean William Morton. And Dean Morton, you're heading off now very shortly to Evensong, and we've been hearing the organ practicing in the background. So a busy evening ahead.
Indeed.
And so there you have it, our insight on the programme to Dean Jonathan Swift and the 350th anniversary of his birthday coming up on the 30th of November. Let's leave you in this part of the programme with the music and choir of St Patrick's Cathedral. Jubilate Deo from Matins, sung by the choristers of St Patrick's Cathedral. David Lee on organ, Stuart Nicholson, the music director. Well, another anniversary was held recently for the birth, 200 years ago, of Baha'u'llah, the founder of the Baha'i Faith. 7 million people worldwide follow the Baha'i Faith, including our guest in the studio this evening, actor, scriptwriter Paddy Dawson. Paddy's a familiar voice from radio drama, including Harbour Hotel, Convenience Corner, and the voice of Stephen Dedalus in Ulysses. Paddy, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much, Michael.
We're talking to you this evening as a member of the Baha'i Faith here in Ireland. For people who mightn't know about that, just give us a little bit of the background.
Well, the Baha'i Faith was founded by the person you mentioned earlier, Baha'u'llah. Now, Baha'u'llah lived from 1817, which is why we're having the bicentenary this year of his birth, great celebrations, and he died in 1892. Well, we've just finished a fantastic period of celebration, but it's continuing through this year. There was a great world mosaic, I think you could describe it as, of celebrations for the 200th anniversary of Baha'u'llah's birth, starting in the middle of the Pacific islands like Kiribati and going right around the world from sunset to the following sunset in Hawaii or somewhere. And Ireland was included in the celebrations, and we had a lot of events throughout this country in relation to the bicentenary.
Now, the background to this faith, it started from a Muslim base, Islam.
In the same way that Christianity began within the Jewish faith, the Baha'i faith did start within the Islamic background. Baha'u'llah himself would have been born into an Islamic family. He was the son of a minister in the court of the Shah of Iran. He was born in Tehran. And it was expected that Baha'u'llah would follow his father into this distinguished position. However, Baha'u'llah himself proved as a young person to be very interested in the poor, the sick. He loved nature. He was very philanthropic in his attitude to things. Now, in his early 20s, he became involved with a number of people in Iran who were expecting the coming of the promised one, not only of Islam, but of all the great faiths in the world, because all the great faiths, as they teach in the Baha'i faith, they have a lot in common with each other. In fact, we don't see them as being opposed to each other in any way. And one of the things they have in common was the looking forward in the future, in a kind of prophetic way, to the time when a special person would come who would bring peace and harmony on the earth. Like for a Christian, that would be God's kingdom coming on earth as it is in heaven, as we say in the Our Father or the Lord's Prayer. So Baha'u'llah then became part of these people, and they began to be heavily persecuted by the authorities.
Yeah, let's put that in context, because yes. for him, as a Muslim, it is in contravention of that belief to deny the Prophet Muhammad.
Well, I am not a theologian of Islam or any other faith, in fact, you know, but actually this was used against, it's still used against Baha'is sometimes internationally. But in fact, when people look at Islam, those who know about it, those I've spoken to, say that this is not the case, that according to Islam, somebody would come in the future. Baha'u'llah later, as this great, his life is such a great drama. It's one of the greatest dramas in history. And anybody interested, just go online to one of the Baha'i websites and you'll find it so fascinating.
Oh, what I do want to talk about is the idea that it's a relatively new faith. You were born into the Church of Ireland.
I was, yes.
So you're
yes.
a convert, and converts very often have an even deeper insight and understanding to a new faith. What was it for you?
Well, as a kid, I was always, you know, involved in church activities. I was in all the clubs that existed, the youth groups, everything like that. And then as you get a little older through your teenage years, you begin to question, why is the church this way, that way, or the other way? And of course, the big thing for me was, in my area, within a few minutes of my house, there were four different branches of Christianity, houses of worship, basically, you know, chapels or churches or whatever, meeting houses. So I began to say, how come my branch of Christianity is right and all the others are wrong? And then what about all these people who are Hindus and Muslims and Sikhs and Zoroastrians? So it was confusing. But I met somebody I was working with who told me a little about the teachings of the Baha'i faith. And he explained that Baha'is believe that all the messengers of God are in a sense like teachers in a school. They're bringing humankind along a pathway, a spiritual evolutionary pathway. And each one brings the same basic spiritual teachings, different social teachings for the age and place to which they come. And the most important thing is to follow the teachings of the most recent of these great manifestations.
So that does
of God.
Mean turning your back on your former teacher then. So for you, in this case, Jesus Christ.
No, Michael, no. The thing is, your teacher will say to you, if you say you're in fourth class in primary school and the teacher is preparing you to go to fifth class, the teacher will say, now it's time for you to go to fifth class. You're ready for that. And you might say, well, I love you so much. I want to stay with you. He will say, if you love me so much, you'll move to the next class. Mm. And similarly, in Christianity, there are many prophecies in the Bible. For those who are interested, Christ said he would come again. He said he would come like a thief in the night. He told his disciples, I have many things to tell you, but you cannot bear them now, howbeit when he, the Spirit of truth, is come. And Baha'is believe that Baha'u'llah's claim is to be that person who is the person foretold by all the major religions, not the branches of religions, in the world.
I'm chatting this evening with Paddy Dawson. We're talking about the Baha'i faith and community. Well represented in Ireland?
It's well represented. It's very widespread. It's small in number. But we have tremendously active communities throughout the country.
How does that manifest itself? So what's worship for you? Do you have a place of worship, and how does a service proceed?
Well, we don't require a place of worship to worship and meet. I will explain. We do have houses of worship. We don't have one in this country. We do have a beautiful Baha'i Centre in Burlington Road in Dublin. But our localities, say from Letterkenny down to Tralee or from Galway to Dublin, meet in each other's houses, maybe in community centres or rented accommodation. And every 3 weeks or so, we have a special meeting, which is our community gathering, which has a devotional aspect, a social aspect, and a consultative aspect.
And is there clergy at the top of the room leading this?
Well, I'm sorry to disappoint you, Michael, but we have no clergy. We at the present time, and for the future, there is no particular individual who has, in inverted commas, a spiritual authority over others.
This weekend, of course, there's an event, which is the Day of the Covenant. Tell us more about that.
Yes.
Tomorrow.
Well, Baha'is believe that the covenant, first of all, what is God? Baha'is believe that we cannot understand what the essence of God is. He is the creator. He, she, or it, whatever you want to say, is the creator. But he maintains a relationship with humanity and has kind of guaranteed that he will never leave humanity to itself. Every so often, he will send a particular messenger to guide humanity onto the next stage of its spiritual evolution. So this is regarded as a covenant, an agreement with God and humankind. And there are some other forms of covenant which I could go into, but that's the main point of covenant.
Sounds like there's a lot of background reading to this. And of course, there's a website, baha'i.ie, where people can find out a little bit more. I wanted to end our conversation this evening, though, on a musical note. And you've introduced a musician to us with a Baha'i background.
Yes. Well, this young man, his name is Luke Slott. And he's a wonderful musician. He plays trumpet, he plays guitar, he plays piano. Some people years ago might have seen him playing his piano in Grafton Street. But since then, he has produced a number of albums. And there's a beautiful Baha'i prayer, which he has set so sensitively to music. And with his beautiful voice and his lovely guitar, it's called Create in Me a Pure Heart.
Create in me a pure heart. Oh my God, oh my God, and renew a tranquil conscience within me, oh my hope, through the Spirit of power, confirm thou me. Confirm thou me in thy cause.
And by Luke Slott and the Baha'i Prayer, Create in Me a Pure Heart. And that's the Leap of Faith for this week. We'll be back at the same time next week. Feel free to drop us an email to faith@rte.ie. From all of us on the programme, good night.
By the light of thy glory.